So, tonight I'd like to speak about a very important topic, probably the most important topic there is in terms of insight meditation, in terms of understanding the nature of our existence, and in terms of liberation. And that is the five aggregates of clinging. You might have heard these words before and kind of just associated them with groups of phenomena or objects, but you haven't really understood them deeply in a very deep and intimate way. And the First Noble Truth of Suffering, after he mentions that birth, disease, old age, and death are suffering, not getting what you want and getting what you don't want are suffering. Then he says, in short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And so it's right there itself lies the whole teaching of suffering. The cause of suffering is the clinging. That's why they call the five aggregates of clinging. The second noble truth is that clinging or craving or desire, attachment, identification with those five aggregates is the source and the reason for the continuation of suffering. So, I want to explore in some detail these aggregates of clinging, because they really make up the focus of one's meditation. Whether you want to or not, you can't get away from the five aggregates, because they make up every facet of conditioned existence, of life in the body and mind. So the first aggregate of clinging is the rupa kanda, or form, the clinging to forms, or rupa. And what are the forms? It is essentially, or basically, it refers to the five objects of sense experience: sight, sound, smells, tastes, touches, and this body. But the most obvious form is our physical body that we cling to. We cling to it as being I, me, and mine. And others regard us as being that person. Now, the matter or form is comprised of the four elements of earth, fire, water, and air, as they are commonly called. But the earth element stands for the hardness or solidness. Anything that we can experience that appears to be kind of hard or solid, tangible, has the quality of earth element. Now these elements, you have to bear in mind, are not elements like you find in chemistry, not some actual element, like clay or something. It's only a quality, a way that matter manifests. It manifests as being hard, soft, extended in space, tangible, so therefore it is called earth element. And the water element, somebody mentioned these in a talk recently, briefly. Water element being that element of cohesion that keeps the earth element together, you might say. Like flour. You could imagine that flour is like the earth element and the water, and you add, then you can knead it together and make something out of flour, out of donut balls and cookies and other things. But in a more meditative sense, because we can't really feel that element of cohesion, the water element is simply those things that are liquidy and watery in the body, such as saliva, tears, urine, blood. And the earth element would be things like the bones, the flesh, the nails, the teeth, the hair. And then there's the temperature element, or the fire element. This can mean any range of temperature in the body, from heat by fever to chill. But it's commonly called the fire element, the heating element, because it causes the digestion and growth process. And then there's the air element. There's air in this body that allows us to move. There's air between even the molecules and cells that allows them to move. If they were all solidly compact together with no space between them, air between them, you'd be like a chunk of concrete. So it's the air element in the body that moves, that allows us to move our limbs. It's also the air going in and out of the lungs, bringing in the prana and the life force that allows us to live. So those four elements, how is it they're the object of clinging? Because whenever we feel hardness in the body, if we're sitting there and we feel, you know, pain in our knees, or where our shin bones are crossed in the cross-legged position, rubbing together, or where our hands are touching together, we feel that sensation, and we call it my hands touching, or pain in my knee. In other words, we identify with it. We cling to it as being mine and belonging to my body. In the same way with we feel the other elements in the body, they're always referred back to belonging to something called my body, a body that belongs to me. So that is how it becomes an object of clinging. But those elements, the four elements, are internal and they're also external. we not only cling to the internal elements, but to the external as well, when we see somebody else's body. We cling to that. That earth element is being a thing and belonging to somebody. Or the water element. If it's raining, you know, we get disturbed by the water element. Or the heat outside. Or the air and the wind. So the internal elements are no different than the external elements. And they're just that. They're just the elements. And they're qualities of matter. They're just how matter manifests. But so in Vipassana meditation, we try to understand what is the real nature of these, and how does the mind come to cling and identify with them and create objects of attachment out of those elements. That in reality, those elements are just energy and vibration. Because really, what is this body? Or what is, you know, bones or even water or heat or air? Isn't it all just atoms and molecules? And atoms and molecules are just made out of electrons. Electrons is just energy, electricity, the natural free electricity or life force, if you'd like to call it that. Of the universe. But through some mysterious process, they've all coagulated and condensed. And grown to produce objects of matter. Of course, this is just elemental physics now. So. But it's important, it's not something to just dismiss, because in a meditation, you try to see it that way in order to be able to let go of anything that might be disturbing your body. We cling to the body as being something real and solid and mine, because you know, it appears to be solid, and it appears to be belonging to oneself. And so when something happens to it, pain, discomfort, the mind clings to it, because it's identifying it as mine. So therefore, the object in Vipassana meditation, one of the aspects of contemplation of the body, the first contemplation in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, after you've gotten the attention drawn inside by observing the breathing, then that sutra has you start analyzing this body as just being the 32 parts. So you're breaking down the whole. First you have a whole body, then you break it down into the 32 parts. One of those parts is not your body. But only when all the parts are together, you call it my body. If your hair falls out and you see your hair on the ground, you don't say, that's my body. You go, ah, that's hair. Or if your fingernail gets ripped off and somebody drops a fingernail on your plate, oh, God, dirty old fingernail. But that, you know, that was part of your body. But so you don't call that your body either. But only when they're all together in a whole, this concept of my body and any other associations with that come into focus. So therefore, in the contemplation of the body, you gradually break that down. And so then you just, you know, you're just seeing it as parts and realizing that these parts are always just changing, and every one of those body parts has a vital role to play in the life of the body. But then you go on breaking it down further and you dissolve those body parts into the four elements and just realize that that toothache that you're feeling is just the earth element. There's a sensation there. Your eyes are closed, right? Even if they're open, you can't see your teeth, can you? Except in a mirror. But because of a sensation of hardness or solidness, the mind imagines or knows that it's a tooth aching. And the mind clings to it as my tooth, my toothache, and then struggles with it. So therefore, the method of insight is to, if you feel anything in the body, especially painful feelings, or any, the mind is starting to hold or cling to any part, you see it as just that elemental vibration. In other words, you just be aware, earth element, earth element. Or if you feel some water in the body, just the water element. Or the air element. Or the fire element. And you keep it at just the elemental level. In other words, you don't create teeth and eyes and bones and other little goodies out of the vibrations. It's simply whatever you feel. If you feel a burning sensation somewhere, you're just aware of the fire element. Or fire element interacting with earth element. The idea of body comes later. The idea of body is created as a thought in the mind, as a concept. Because of clinging. So that's the way that one investigates the body. That's part of the investigation of Dhamma, which is one of the, is the second factor of enlightenment, to investigate the Dhammas. And that means to investigate the five aggregates, because the Dhamma is just the five aggregates. Every conceivable Dhamma fits into the five aggregates, except Nibbana. So, and then we can focus that attention outside, and when we see something, and our mind starts clinging to an object, that is also just the earth element or the water element or the fire element or the air element. And so, again, that prevents the mind from turning those elemental vibrations into objects that we would then cling to. It creates them into objects that we have our likes and our dislikes to, and then the mind gets stuck on them. And you might think, oh, that's all well and good and blah, 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 but, you know, I'll just, you know, watch my breathing. But there's a story that a monk attained enlightenment by that method. There's a story of a monk in Sri Lanka. He lived on a hill, and there was a village nearby. And He used to walk to the village for alms. And his meditation subject was the earth element. In other words, he was just training his mind to see everything as just bones. You know, not people, not animals, not this and not that, but just, you know, earth element. If you saw a tree, just earth element. If you saw a person, just earth element. And so one day he was walking toward the village, keeping this in mind. And a woman came running out of the village, having just washed her hair, and ran by the monk. And just as she was about to pass him, right in front of him, he just, you know, sort of lifted up his eyes, and she smiled at him. And all he saw was the white of the teeth and the bones. And that filled up his whole mind, and he saw the emptiness of it, and attained enlightenment right on the spot. Developed insight and attained enlightenment right while he was standing there. And then after she went away, after sort of euphoria calmed down in the monk, he started walking again. And then a husband came running out of the village and that stopped the monk and said, "Did you see a woman run by here, my wife?" And the monk replied, "I don't know if it was man, woman, or beast, but some bones went by." You see? Now, if he would have seen that woman as a woman, and then perhaps old desires or lust or attachment or anything else, or judging she was beautiful or not, then that would have defiled his mind or created suffering for him. But no, he stopped right there with the bare elemental perception and attained enlightenment. So, you know, it's a very profound, even though you might kind of dismiss it and think, oh, that, you know, that sounds this way or that way, or I don't believe that. It's very profound. In fact, the sutra on the contemplation of the body, you've all heard of the Satipatthana Sutra, which is a sutra on the four foundations of mindfulness. But there's also a sutra just given on contemplation of the body, just on the first one, a separate sutra in itself, just on the contemplation of the body. And in that, he said, just with this contemplation of the body, one can attain full enlightenment. So let us go on to the next aggregate of clinging, is feelings or sensations. There was some talk on this already. And of course, the feelings that we have in the body are probably the most troublesome to us during meditation. Painful, especially the painful ones. But also the feelings that arise based on sounds, on the contact. Feeling arises from contact. And some sounds produce a pleasant sensation, others a painful sensation. And the same with sights, smells, tastes, even thoughts. Now these feelings are also impermanent, and they're conditioned. In other words, they're not really our feelings. They're programmed into us since babyhood. And by the way that we've been conditioned and taught by others, by our parents, friends, teachers, even the priests in the church, or the temple, or the government, you know, we've been sort of programmed, you know, what to like, what not to like, even by very subtle ways. Like even on advertising, it's a very subtle way of programming feelings. to think that this type of food or this cosmetic is the best one or bad or worse. But it's the way that we formed our likes and dislikes to things, to keep it simple. It's basically that initial attraction or aversion to any of the sense stimulations. Now, the pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings are associated with greed, hatred, and ignorance. The pleasant sensations are associated with greed, because we desire, we crave the pleasant sensations. Unpleasant sensations are associated with hatred, because we want to get rid of them. We don't like them. Or hate things. You always say, I hate this, I hate that, I hate that music, I hate this kind of food. Because it produces an unpleasant sensation or feeling. And the neutral sensations, they're associated with ignorance. Because even though you might not be able, you might not be reacting with attachment or aversion in your meditation, there might not be any painful or pleasant feelings, and you're just feeling comfortable there, hanging out in a kind of, and thinking everything is neutral. But yet, that produces the sense of self, ignorance. It kind of makes the mind lazy. And stuck in it's just its sense of self. It's the pleasurable and the painful ones that normally affect us the most, so we can actively investigate those, but the neutral ones, because they don't cause any ripples, we just get complacent and kind of just kick back in our little groove or sense of self and hang out. So that's ignorance. Really, the basic ignorance is the sense of self. When we talk about ignorance, the deepest meaning of ignorance, although you say it, ignorance means ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, but all of that boils down to the concept of self or duality. It's that subject-object way of experiencing everything that comes into the senses with this idea of I am the experiencer. I am separate from these objects. So that sense of self is really the basic ignorance. And it's from that that self forms its attachments or aversions. Now coming back to these feelings can be, you can observe that they're impermanent because they can be changed. We can change our feelings if we want to. We can change the types of things that we like or dislike. I always tell the little story about my own experience as a boy, and I hated avocados. They produced a terrible, unpleasant sensation in me whenever I even heard the name. My mother said, "We're having avocados tonight in a salad," and I would send a shudder up my spine, and I'd remember about this horrible, the smell of it, that at least as I thought it was. And she forced me to eat it. And I couldn't have my dessert to watch television afterwards until I had, eaten it all. But it almost made me vomit, just the smell of it, to pick it up. I couldn't explain why, but it was really a very, very painful, unpleasant sensation based on smell, and even the sight of it, and even the hearing of it. So we'll go through three doors, through the ear, through the eye, and through the nose, I was suffering due to this clinging to this unpleasant sensation. Thinking it was real. Thinking that avocado really had horrible taste. Luckily, we had a cat that used to come around at dinner time, and when Mother wasn't looking, I used to slip at the avocados, and for some reason it liked avocados. So, but when I got to India and Sri Lanka, many years later, of course, and started studying the Dharma and heard about this nature of feelings, I remembered this thing about avocados. And I came across some avocados in Sri Lanka. And I thought, now is the time to test this, to see if the Buddha was really, you know, talking the truth about these feelings. So I went to get avocado and to force myself to eat it and to see if I could change my relationship to it. So I got the avocado and, you know, cut it up. And in the beginning, of course, I had to hold my nose and eat it. But, and meditating on it at the same time, and I would gag, and I almost vomited a few times. But gradually, I was, you know, just seeing that that's conditioned, that that's really, there's no truth in that. This is just nervous system reaction. And little by little, I overcame it. And I started to like avocados, and now I like avocados. They produce pleasant feeling when I hear we're having them for lunch, or see them in the salad. You see? So to me, that was a very profound, even though it sounds kind of simple, that was very, very profound for me to see that it was all in the mind. So you can apply that experience to every other experience, every other like or dislike that you have in regard to any of the sense objects. Because if you can do it for one, you can do it for all of them. So that is the meaning of feelings are not self. That means they're not real. They don't have any inherent concrete existence of their own, that this thing is absolutely painful or this thing is absolutely pleasurable. But it only has that value to the experiencer and how that experiencer has been conditioned. Because you could put that avocado, or you could put an object out here, and everyone would have a sort of a different reaction to it. Some may not like it, some may like it, others may be kind of just neutral to it in various shades. So you can see that's all in the mind. But it's the clinging to those feelings and thinking that are real that have caused so much suffering to ourselves and others, because we'll kill after them. Or lie, cheat, steal, plunder, rape, by memory, you know, associating these objects with feelings. And we think that they're really ours. They're really real to us. Now the next aggregate is perceptions. Anything that we feel, we perceive. Now the level of feeling is sort of comes before the mind has actually started thinking about the object. It's just a real gut, sort of the initial gut reaction to a thing before you've actually really kind of even fully cognized the thing. But then you perceive it, that smell. And then you give it a name or a label. And it becomes an object. Or that sensation, that sound sensation, visible sensation, odor, flavor. From that initial raw vibration, you give it a name or a label, and it becomes a perception. To keep it simple, it's simply the way the mind can distinguish one thing from another. In other words, it separates something out of the whole background to stand out in time and space as being this object as opposed to another object. That's the perception. That we might call man or woman, animal, tree, car, house. Or its shape as being round, square, tall, short. So it's kind of just a, you know, crystallized, you know, mental image, or just a thought. So it turns that sound that you hear outside from just sound vibration into crickets. That would be a perception. Or the sound you're hearing here coming from this direction, you call the monk talking. And it's a perception. And when you're sitting in meditation and you feel all these various sensations threaded together, the perception of I am sitting arises. The perception of this is my body arises. That's also just a perception. The body is a perception. The body is a thought in the mind, produced from all the various sensations and the feelings that you're experiencing. The mind is sort of threading them all together, from the feeling in your toes, to the feeling in the breathing, to the feeling in the hair on the head, and everything in between. Like a computer, the mind is threading them all together and come up with, I am sitting in this posture, or I am standing, or I am laying down, according to the input of sensations. If you just feel your toe, you don't call your toe your body. Or just your finger, or your eye. But because all of them are kind of being threaded together, because all this data is being relayed through the nervous system to the mind, and it kind of creates a composite out of it, that you know it's the body. And that's a perception. But we cling to that perception as being my body. I mean mine. Or another person's body. We see a form, another person's body. What we see is just a visible impact on the eye, a visible vibration in a certain color or shape. That's the actual material vibration that's striking the eye, the rupa. But then the mind perceives that as being, you know, a person, woman or a man, or flowers or anything. And then we cling to that. Begin with the likes or dislikes. That's why the perceptions are called the aggregate of clinging, because we cling to them. And the memories associated with them also arise at the same time. And the next to arise are the volitional formations, or what is called the sankhara khanda. Okay, we might perceive a thing as being this person, but then a memory about that person will arise, and you might start forming aversion, or hatred, or remembering something about that person. So-and-so did this to me, that to me. And then that triggers off so many other emotions. And then maybe some decision to take, well, I'm going to do something about that. All of those belong to the sankharas, meaning the volitional, the determining factors in the mind. The things and the habit patterns that make us to take decisions, and all included all the emotional reactions, sadness, happiness, gladness, anger, hatred, jealousy, envy, pride, conceit. But they all arise based upon these perceptions. And we cling to those mental activities as being ourself. I am deciding. I am wanting this. I am thinking this. I am deciding to do that. I like this, I don't like this. But all of those mental formations are just conditioned also. Because we've been programmed to act and think in those ways, in the way that we've learned all of our life and cultivated habits that were programmed into us, again, from our being raised up. Because in the time when you were a tiny, tender little baby laying in the crib, you know, in the first days of your life, you might not have much of a sense of self or I, and maybe even no directed craving or likes and dislikes. But then gradually, as you grew up and the mother or the father started giving you things and you started seeing things and reaching out for them, and the mother slapping you and saying, "No, this is bad, don't touch that," or giving you other things, and you know, you become the center of attention when you're a baby. By your mother either scolding you or spanking you or giving you things, or coddling you. All the relatives coming over giving you presents. And you start to, this feeling of I am somebody starts to crystallize. The sense of self starts to get crystallized because of all this attention that's being given to you. As we go on, it gets more and more, depending on the sorts of attention that one gets during a childhood. And then the attachments that are formed to the things that we experience. So that sense of self grows as the child grows up, that self of sense of importance. But then what happens? After you've lost that little cuteness of a cute little kid, you know, and that cute little kid starts to turn into a monster, you see? Or you grow old enough and go out to the house, then no one is paying much attention to you anymore. Now you just become a cog in the wheel. You know? Nothing special anymore. Maybe your friends or your family die and you're kind of on your own. Nobody's paying any more attention to you. And that creates deep psychological personality conflicts in people because they've used to be in the center of attention. Somebody important and real and really identified with that as they grew up in case of, you know, like spoiled kids and so on. But then due to changing situations, all of a sudden you're kind of out on the street on your own. You know, nobody giving you much importance. You got to fend for yourself. And all these ideas or concepts of values based on self, self-worth, self-esteem, inferiority complexes, judging oneself with others, I'm better or worse off than others. You know, all of that psychological problems also develops by identifying with that sense of self. But the last aggregate of clinging is the consciousness itself. Now, I like to describe that as really being the ego consciousness. It talks of terms in vijnana as the aggregate of clinging. Clinging to the consciousness, we cling to it as I'm the one that's hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. In pure awareness, you don't have that concept of I am seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. Therefore, it's not an object of clinging, and it doesn't bring suffering. And it's only when we cling to the consciousness as being I, me, mine that the suffering arises. And it's that consciousness and sense of self that kind of ties all the other things together, the form, the feelings, the perceptions, and the volitional activities, and relates them back to this I that am doing and experiencing these things. So taken all together, the five aggregates of clinging are called the person pack. Like there's a little sutra, a short sutra in the Sanyutta Nikaya called the person pack, or the burden. The burden is these five aggregates of clinging. The bearer of this burden is man, or anybody who's clinging to him. Taking up the burden, that means identifying them as self, is suffering. Laying down the burden, that means giving up the identification as self to them, is freedom. So those five aggregates of clinging, you know, are sort of always functioning in our life, and they include the past, the present, and the future. All the forms, feelings, perceptions, memories, emotions, ideas about self from the past and the present, and even the ones that will be in the future. They are just those aggregates of clinging. Now, coming down to the actual meditation experience, the five aggregates of clinging are also all coming together in each moment of sense experience, in each what we call mind moment. Really what the mind is, and the mind is actually those four aggregates, the last four aggregates, the mental process. There's nothing in you that's a mind that kind of sitting somewhere that you can kind of locate and say that's the mind and it's producing all these things. But it's a process of feeling, perception, or memory, the volitional activities, reacting to them, and the consciousness itself. And they are stimulated by the form. In other words, it takes contact with a sense stimulus. And they are stimulated by the form. In other words, it takes contact with a sense stimulus, which is the matter, the aggregate of matter, sound touching the ear that springs into activity, the feeling, the perception, the volitional activities, and a sense of I am hearing. All of that arises, you might say, in a moment, based on a contact. That is called a mind moment, a moment of hearing, or seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. So all those five aggregates, you might say, come together and make up a conscious mind moment, a full cognition with the object. And then it passes away, only to be followed by another one almost immediately, and then another one. As was mentioned in other talks, the mind can only fully cognize and notice one object at a time. That's because of this, the way the mind functions in just a momentary sequence. And the Buddha called this the all. There's a sutra called Sabbasutta, the all. He said, what is the all? It is sounds and hearing, visible objects and seeing, odors and smelling, flavors and tasting, tangibles and feeling, mind objects and cognizing. And if you can show me anything else beside just these moments of that, it'll be impossible to do so. So what that implies is that what we call our life, or the mental process, is simply moments of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking, reacting to those things as well as just remembering things on its own, even without the physical stimulations. And those moments arise and vanish away. But we don't see the breaks in between. Now, any one of those mind moments is nothing in itself. One mind moment is not enough for the mind to really kind of start thinking. Even when you hear those crickets out there, if you just heard one little cricket chirp and wasn't followed by any others, the idea of a cricket probably wouldn't even come in your mind, because that could have, one little isolated sound could have been a number of things. But because it's repeating over and over again, then the memory of what that sound is and what its meaning is, how you've learned it in school, by associating certain sounds with the animal pages on the coloring book, that is that thing. Or a bird chirping. One little chirp of a bird, you can't tell if it's a cardinal or a wren or a whippoorwill or an owl. Maybe some could. But, most people wouldn't. But it's only when the sounds go on repeating. So one mind instant in itself has really no meaning for the mind. It's not enough to really stimulate some things, of course. Sure, if you hear one lightning bolt, strike down or something like that. But in general, we're talking about how the mind perceives and gets attached to things. And the clearest simile to illustrate the nature of the mind, the mental process, is that of a motion picture or a reel of film. A reel of film is just made up of individual frames, isn't it? Is it? Individual frames, right? And that frame's got a gap in between. If you look at one frame of a movie reel, it probably won't do anything to you, won't stimulate anything. But when that movie is run through a projector fairly quickly with light, you don't see the gaps in between. And so what you see appears to be a fluid, continuous activity that appears kind of real. And if you're sitting there in the movie house and watching, and you're clinging that to be a real thing, and you start, getting a passion for some beautiful man or woman on the screen, or you're rooting for the Cowboys or the Indians, or, getting all involved. Then at the end of the movie, you want to go meet that actor. I want to go meet that person. So you go back to the projector room. And, say, where's the actor? And the film man kind of looks at him, looks at you and say, what's this guy been drinking? And he says, there's no actor here. He said, well, give me that roll of film. I want to find him. So you look through that and you finally come to that empty frame and realize, what is this? I was fooled. I was tricked. And you throw down the reel of film. Now you might think that's a cute or funny little simile, but
know, it's really very close to the way the mind is working and producing the illusion of concreteness in reality, especially the sense of I am. Because with each moment of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking, the sense of I am doing it arises as that vijnana, as that consciousness. Because we don't see the gaps in between. If we see the gap in between, the ego, the sense of self, subsides for that moment. But we don't, because our perception is so slow, we're only seeing, you know, we see the things all run together. We can't keep up with the rate of arising and vanishing. And the mind is just clinging. And we don't see the arising and vanishing of mind moments. So we don't see the arising and vanishing of the self, of the sense of self. So we take it to be real. Just as we take that roll of film or get all passionate and hot under the collar over, you know, some movie. But this, what we call our normal life, has no more real substance than that. Except it's just sort of kind of permanently lodged in the mind. But really, Vipassana meditation is tuning in to those mind moments. And that is what is called anicca. The real meaning of anicca is not that this body grows old and eventually dies. Of course, that is one meaning. Or even that sound, you know, the bird chirps for a couple minutes and then stops. Anicca. Or people get in an accident and total out their car and they say anicca. It's very common in Buddhist countries, you know. Everything's anicca, anicca. But the real anicca is that anicca of each mind moment. And you tune into that process of mind moments. And build up momentum. And you don't limit it to just the body, but be a mind moment alternating between body, sound, thought, smell, taste, touch, you know, going back and forth in all directions. But you gradually build up momentum in that and build up your rate of perception so that your rate of perception is nearing the rate of the arising and vanishing of things coming through the senses, because you're not clinging. If you cling, it's finished, it's over, you can't keep up. And when you can keep up with that rate of arising and vanishing, there's no time for the mind to cling to any one thing, and so even a sense of the self starts to get very tenuous and kind of just starts to fade away. Because the mind doesn't even have time to really perceive or think or hold on to any objects. And so the reality starts to crumble, fade away. Until at a certain experience when the factors of enlightenment and faith, energy, concentration, mindfulness and wisdom, those faculties that were talked about the other night are ripe, then that condition process is suspended. The five aggregates of clinging are no longer clung to. And the mind experiences a whole new radical quality of awareness that's free from that self that's in there trying to grasp and manipulate or do anything. And there's no more pleasure or pain also arising. So that is really, you know, the process of Vipassana meditation. Vipassana, of course, people have translated it in many different ways. But seeing reality as it is normally the way it's. And The way reality is just that, mind moments arising and vanishing. Without any owner who owns or controls the consciousness or who they belong to. That is how reality is, in accordance with reality. And so, you know, in the deepest sense, that is, you know, what Vipassana is. And so you've got to investigate it that way. Investigation of Dhamma means you investigate whatever is happening in terms of applying that understanding of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, or impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness or the suffering that arises if you cling to those things that are impermanent, and the sense that they don't really belong to anyone. They're essentially of an empty nature. When we say a thing is empty, we're not saying it doesn't exist. We're saying it doesn't exist the way that we think it exists. In other words, it doesn't have any concrete meaning or reality. It does have some temporary reality and meaning, but it's, you know, it's empty of any real concrete substance to it, except for what the mind gives it. So in the practice of Vipassana, the two predominant factors in Vipassana are, it's called sati and panya, or mindfulness and wisdom. Now, just mindfulness alone is not enough. You could be mindful and say, oh, I'm hearing that sound, just hearing. But if you still think that you are the meditator, you are meditating, you are hearing, there's no panya there. You might be mindful of a sound in one moment, or you might be mindful of the pain in your knee, or mindful of the restlessness in your mind, but if you still are locked in that subject-object relationship and disturbed by them, then there's no panya. So you need panya to cut off the defilement, to go down and cut around the root of the clinging. Sati is like you isolate the moment in the mind, like, okay, there's a sensation there, or sound, or a thought. It's like taking a clump of rice stalks in the hand. You know, you've got this clump of rice stalks, like you've grabbed this moment of pride that arose in your mind, and you say, aha, I got you, pride, there you are. And then with wisdom, it's like a sword that whacks it off. That means the wisdom knows that this pride is not myself, it's nothing, it's just an empty bubble, it has no reality, it doesn't belong to anybody. That's wisdom. That's the function of wisdom. And that causes you to let it go like a hot potato. Or the sound. You're sitting there meditating. Nice and quiet and cozy. Kind of, you know, you're almost, you know, seeing that white light. Then all of a sudden, what happens? The neighbor's dogs start barking terribly, or you start shooting off some guns, or maybe somebody in the room starts coughing terribly. Now, sati, mindfulness, would be aware of hearing, just hearing the sound,
But unless you have the wisdom to know that no one is hearing actually, then you still might get disturbed by that sound, even though you have mindfulness to know that you're hearing. Still, if the punya is clinging to you as the hearer, or still, you know, clinging to that object as being real, it will disturb you nevertheless. You won't be able to shake it off. So the punya investigates it. What is the nature of this sound that's being heard? What is the nature of this sense of self that thinks it's hearing something? What is this nature of this perception that thinks that I even have a body here? So that punya, that investigation goes investigating. No, this body is simply, this is simply earth element, water element, fire element, air element. It's just vibration. That sound coming through the ear is just sound vibration. There's no dog in that vibration. There's no any individual object. And therefore there's no attachment arise because of that. The attachment arises because of the clinging to the feeling and to the perception. Taking that sound or dog to be barking to be real and disturbing you. So punya analyzes that mental process into its elemental nature, and therefore you can let go. Because in as long as we still believe that we are the doer and that things are real, then we'll always be suffering by that. When you see their falsity, their emptiness, then there's liberation immediately. Like a story of a man who moves into a new neighborhood and is moving his things into the house from the moving van, and across the street there's a young man who's kind of just, you know, mentally retarded. And he's kind of making faces and laughing and giggling and at the man, new neighbor who's moving in. And kind of, you know, making grunts and, you know, kind of just doing things. But he's just doing those things because he's that way. Not because he has any real hatred or anything towards that person, perhaps. But the man thinks so. The new neighbor says, "Why is that person laughing at me? He doesn't like the color of my hair or, you know, what I'm driving or my kids." Or... And every time he looks over, the man is looking at him and kind of, you know, making little funny sounds and just... But, you know, that man is really taking it to be real. And, you know, that person is insulting me and really getting upset. But then later on, another neighbor comes over and says, "No, don't bother with that person. That person's mentally retarded. He's been that way since birth. You know, he doesn't mean any harm. He doesn't even know what he's doing." Oh. Then relief. Then that man realizes, oh, that's just the way it is. He's not really doing this to me. He does that to everyone. And so you lose your anger toward. How can you remain angry at him? Because you've understood the situation. In the same way when we get angry with others. Even all people are basically, from a Dharma point of view, mentally retarded. I mean, you know, kind of sick.
so that people that get angry and irritable is just because they have those defilements, just like we do. It's not that they're a bad person. So that's the way you've got to analyze. That's how you investigate. And whatever is sticking in our experience, whatever is causing trouble, we investigate it until that disturbance falls away. So that is the method of practice. And combining sati and the punya. The punya has to be there. And in the beginning, the punya will take the form of sort of discursive thinking. We use the Buddhist teachings as a map. We read these aspects of the four foundations of mindfulness, contemplation of the body, feelings. We study this, the nature of karma, cause and effect. We intellectually kind of understand this idea of impermanence, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So we have something to work with, some sort of direction. And so we sit down with that, and then as things start to arise in us, we investigate them according to that, what is called sutramaya punya. Wisdom is of three kinds. There's sutramaya punya, which means the wisdom of hearing. You hear a lecture like this, you read sutras. So it gives you some intellectual knowledge. But that produces your interest. It gives you some faith or hope. But then you got to go on thinking about it. If you just read it once or twice, or hear a talk, and then don't go on contemplating it, thinking about it over and over again, you're liable to forget about it. And the interest won't grow. So you go on thinking about it. That's called chintamaya panya. In your daily life, when you see things happening, by paying attention, you see, yes, because of the sound, this person's getting angry, and And so the meaning of these things grows in the mind as you go on thinking about them. So in meditation, the first part of Vipassana meditation involves some of this chintamaya panya. This idea that you just sit down and you try not to think anything and just have pure awareness. Most people can't do that, even though they want to. They're not going to be successful in it, at least not for a long, long time. Because other factors haven't been cultivated yet. People have too much monkey mind. Even going to retreats for years and years. So therefore, we can use that chintamaya punya and discursive analytical thinking even while we're meditating. Because if you read the Satipatthana Sutra, that's what it is. He says, sits down and sees this body is just 32 parts, four elements. This is the element of earth. This is form, this is feeling, this is perception. It's all there, very clear. So you use that chintamaya panya until that wisdom becomes so ingrained in the mind you don't have to think about it anymore. Just like tying your shoelaces. Or doing some other task. But when that wisdom is fully matured, combined with this mindfulness and the other factors, supporting factors, then that thinking just falls away all by itself. And you get what is called the bhavanamaya panya, or the non-verbal direct penetration of the truths. It's when that conditioned mind shell falls away and you experience that emptiness. Or other little glimpses and insights that come along the way. So there's nothing wrong with using the mind in meditation to think about these things, especially in the Vipassana system. Because it's better than just spending the whole hour just in monkey mind. We've got to replace wrong thinking, erratic thinking, with skillful thinking, with right thinking. And so there's nothing wrong with right thinking, thinking about the Dhamma. That is Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of Dhamma. But it's for the purpose of letting go of what you're holding on to. Once the mind lets go of what it's holding on to, then of course, you know, you don't need to utilize that any longer. It stops by itself. So the balance of how to balance those different factors of also of concentration, of mindfulness, and wisdom. That factor of concentration that keeps us concentrated, it keeps us grounded. So you keep coming back to the breathing or just to the sensation of the body sensation of being grounded, as that serves as the concentration factor. To keep the mind steady, or keep it from getting too far out in left field. Keeps it in the general vicinity. And then the mindfulness is the alertness that sees or notices a sound or sensation or thought that comes through. And then you kind of isolate it and say, ah, yes, here it is. And then the wisdom cuts off the ignorance concerning. So those three factors have to be balanced. And it's only with a lot of practice that you learn how to balance those factors. If there's not enough concentration, if there's too much thinking and kind of just investigating, then the mind could get too distracted and too disturbed because it isn't tempered by that calmness. So that's why you use, at the same time you're investigating, you're still investigating in this body and mind, which is, you know, you're concentrated in the body and mind. So it's a form of concentration. It's not jhana, but you don't need that jhana to that state of concentration to practice Vipassana. So it's just that mental composure and centeredness enough to keep the attention somewhat in the general vicinity of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, in the body and the mind. And then the alertness, and then understanding what you're alert at, understanding what you are experiencing. So I think that might be enough food for thought for one this talk. And if anybody has any questions, try to clear something up if something was confusing. Or
they all seem to kind of come together, as you said, in a lying moment, because how can one have craving for something physical if not through the senses?
Right. Craving arises dependent on feeling, and feeling is dependent on contact. And contact is dependent on the sixfold sense sphere being intact and working.
So,
You were mentioning the five aggregates.
Yes. Sensation. Since perception would be the trouble expressing my thoughts. I'm sorry.
No, an object contacts the senses and produces a sensation, a feeling.
So how
and you perceive that. The mind perceives.
Yes. How can there be clinging to the object? Actually what you're clinging to is the perception of the object. Unless you're actually holding the object with your hands.
Mm.
And
but sometimes let's say like a screeching sound.
So it's a momentary thing, like, in other words, like, let's say, the first millisecond that you put something in your mouth that tastes good, that millisecond, that actual taste sensation, even at that very point, well, the first thing, the only way you're aware of it, though, is through your sense.
Yeah, but that pleasant or unpleasant sensation could arise before actually knowing what the object is.
And then
in the sense of an odor. There could be an odor come by and you wouldn't like it, but you may not have fully identified what it was.
But you only know what the object is through your perception.
The name and labeling of the object.
So basically, it probably doesn't really do any good to try to unravel.
Yeah, don't try to.
So linked so tightly together, it's almost like they're almost like one.
Yeah, it's said to be like a soup. If you have a soup and it's got various kind of spices in it, in a general way, you could say, yes, this has got cardamom and pepper and nutmeg and cinnamon. But you couldn't really actually separate those out on your tongue. You see, the whole soup would have a certain flavor. But within that flavor, you could notice that there were different things. So it's sort of with the sense experience. That all those elements of the sense experience are, you know, sort of come together. Although there is a very millisecond gap in between, but only a Buddha could really actually have the insight to actually see that to that extreme. But that extreme is not that important. It's simply when we understand that it's happening that way, the thing is to get us to let go of the object. If we know that it's impermanent, and if we cling to it, we suffer. Even if we don't actually see it fully, if we're totally convinced and believe in that, we let it go.
I have just one more brief question. Today when I was taking a shower, work, doing something, I began to, contemplate my body and my actions, like what you were saying. And it occurred to me that my body is, my actions were like an automaton, like a robot. In other words, there were sensations, and then somehow a message, well, you can't say the message was being sent to my mind, but the sensation is a message. I don't know exactly how it works because the mind is everywhere. But so there's a sensation, and then there's a conditioned reaction based on previous, sankharas, perceptions, and so forth. And the body just keeps on, you know, the body and the mind in the sense, and everything we do just keeps on going. It's like that motion picture.
Yes.
Except we're the actor, but we're not even aware of it. And a feeling of kind of revulsion. Like, we're all, like, all of us are just a bunch of
babbling idiots.
Yeah, well, worse. I mean, we're actually, there's nothing but, we're not really acting on our own at all. I mean, if there isn't, well, the own is an illusion anyways. So since the own is an illusion, all we are is just a bunch of conditioned responses, totally meaningless. It's like just, and that is kind of, it makes life seem kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand the Buddha said life is suffering.
Conditioned life that's led just by the ignorant mind.
Existence as anybody who's not enlightened, it's like totally, it's not only meaningless, but it's something, there's something disgusting about it, because it's like we think, we attach this importance and significance to these totally inane, meaningless, irrelevant and irreverent actions which purposes are misunderstood anyways in our own minds.